hi, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, January 10th, 2019. I read that, so I didn't say 2018 for a change. Okay, it is 2019, and welcome to today's show, which is with one of my favorite organizations, which is the Council of Chief State School Officers. Now, we're not going to be talking to a chief state school officer today. Usually we do. We kind of go around the country with that, and they're just wonderful, I find, more and more as I talk to them. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Saroja Warner, and Dr. Warner is the program director for, let me get this straight, the Diverse and Learner Ready Teachers Initiative from CCSSO, and she's got a great background here, and I'm sure she's doing great work over at CCSSO, and I'm looking forward to learning more about the Diverse and Learner Ready Teachers Initiative coming down from your chief state school officers and their organization, CCSSO. Excuse that cough. I should have done it before the show started. All right, we're going to archive the show over at our website, education-talkradio.org. We put a new schedule up there every Saturday. All right, and also we tweet over at EduTalk Radio, Facebook, the same thing. You can follow us, LinkedIn at EduTalk Larry. Go over there, check it out. You can follow us. We'll send you a link to every show as soon as we're done. We put them up there. We know a lot of listeners go through that particular area. Please also check out, again, diversity has a lot to do with this. Please check out our magazine, which is digital. It's called Accessibility, Compliance, and Equity in Education. We call it AC&E. A-C-N-E, ampersand, and it's at ace-ed.org. It's a digital magazine, but the whole issue is up there. We have a new one coming out in about 2 weeks, and then we'll archive the one that's up there right now. But it's a nice website. Please go over your important topics in education. We try to cover what we can, and we hope you enjoy it and share it with your friends, ace-ed.org. And as I used to say in the Tonight Show, we're spinning here, but here's Saroja. Hello, Saroja. It's Larry.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really great, especially with the release of our guidance paper today that I'm excited to talk about.
Well, tell us. I'm going to start right there. Tell us what that's about and how people would access it, et cetera. Go ahead. You're on.
All right.
That was a simple start. Let's do it.
That's right. So, you know, today we're talking about CCSSO's Diverse and Learner Ready Teachers Initiative. And I know it's a mouthful, but, you know, each word is actually really important because it is an indication of what states are working on doing. And that is increasing the racial diversity of the teacher workforce. So it's more reflective of that diversity of our kids. And at the same time, ensure all teachers, regardless of race, are what we call learner ready, and particularly that they are culturally responsive in practice.
Ooh.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And the paper that's been released today that has been made available on CCSSO's website, if you are following CCSSO on Twitter, I encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Saroja Warner. We have been sharing this widely with everyone. What the paper does, Larry, is it is an important vision for success. So in other words, if we got this right, if we made sure that our workforce was racially diverse and that teachers were culturally responsive, what would the experiences for students and teachers in our schools look like? And it is so important, this vision, Larry, because we need to have some consensus, right, about what it is we're trying to accomplish. And what is beautiful about this paper is it represents the consensus of the 10 states in this initiative right now, as well as over 30 national collaborating organizations. And then the paper also, obviously, what we do at CCSSO, creates some guidance, right? So there are some suggested actions for policy and practice to achieve the vision.
Will it go beyond 10 states? I thought you were going to say 50, but you said 10.
Let me tell you something. It will go beyond 10. Ultimately, the goal
is that
all states, all states. The initiative is sort of our first attempt, you know, to bring some states together, because you know how it's how it is, to get consensus like this. And so,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
Ask President Trump and Nancy Pelosi what it's like, and they'll tell you. We all know
right?
what it's like these days. Hard to get consensus, right? Yeah.
That's right. It really is. That's what's so remarkable, I think, about what this paper, beyond, I think, the vision and the guidance that's in there, it really does represent consensus. I'll tell you, too, consensus not just, among these sort of wonky-wonk, policy leaders, and people sitting in ivory towers, but the consensus of ed prep providers, the people who prepare teachers in these states,
mm-hmm.
it represents consensus amongst local school district superintendents, teachers, as well as principals. The opening section of the paper has three just wonderful vignettes by three state teachers of the year from Colorado, from Delaware, and from Louisiana.
Nice diversity right there, cutting that big triangle across the country. I have to ask you, and I'm sure this is on people's minds, and I know everyone's intentions are good, okay? But, and I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, actually Rich Long over from Learning First. I was talking to him about this yesterday. And I was saying, when I was younger, much younger and in school, and you look back on history, and I was a history teacher, teaching seemed to be something – that when new immigrant groups came in and that first group went to college, that next generation, so many of them became teachers. It was a wonderful way into the middle class. And hence, we had a lot of different – and we had different ethnicity, if I may, if I'm pronouncing that right, amongst my
mm-hmm.
teachers. When I grew up in Philadelphia, okay, went all through Philadelphia public schools. This was when it was still a colony. That's how old I am. Okay, I went to school with William Penn. It's been a while. Okay, but – okay, my question is I know we want to get the teachers to look like the students, so to speak, and get them more diverse, et cetera. But how do we do that? It seems like today, and I think I'm just going to use these groups, if I may, Latinos, I'll say people of color, okay,
mm-hmm.
African Americans, Latinos, people from East India, whatever the case may be, all right. They don't seem to be going into teaching. They seem to be going into the sciences, et cetera. And I'm curious, how do we accomplish what you want to accomplish? I think it's wonderful
mm-hmm.
we're trying, and we've got to keep trying. Okay?
That's right.
But
how
do we do it? Well, the methodology behind it.
That is a really great question. And, I think part of the challenge in being able to respond to that very important question is perhaps, and this is what I have been encouraging my colleagues in this space to do, is that we have to rethink how we are recruiting teachers.
Yes.
We have to rethink even who, like the criteria we use to determine who would be a good teacher candidate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
sure.
There are a lot of folks, people of color, who actually want to go into teaching, but because of a variety of barriers and restrictions, we can talk about things like the financial cost of becoming a teacher, the licensing requirements, some of the testing requirements. Sometimes you've got folks that go into the profession and leave very early on because of working conditions in schools. So there's this challenge around not only the recruitment, but what the research is showing us is that we really need to pay attention to retaining high quality of all races, right? That is really where we're losing our workforce is on the back end in retention.
And we don't have and what you're also saying, if I may extrapolate that, we don't have that pipeline of diversity coming in.
That's right. We don't have a pipeline of diversity coming in. And so we need to think a little bit more about how we might do that. I'll say that one promising strategy that states and school districts are using is to really invest in their Grow Your Own programs. I mean, you and I both know, and our audience on the show today know this too, that we all make decisions about just where we want to live, where we want to settle down, raise families, develop our social networks, and that a lot of that is driven by things like, services and communities that are available to us, how welcome we feel by communities. And so when you're talking about people of color, look, I myself am a woman of color. My parents came from Trinidad in the early 70s. And I grew up in this country, and my parents settled in a suburban, you know, sort of middle class community in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I remember, you know, just sort of how challenging it was as a human living in that place. Never mind, you know, that I wasn't a teacher. I was just a young person. And then later on becoming a teacher and teaching in the very district where I was schooled, a district that did not represent, you know, the diversity that I was, right? That did not, I talked about, you know, being from Trinidad, and people are like, where's that? You know, things have gotten better these days, but they don't even know where Trinidad was or what it was. And so then being a teacher, and there were very few teachers of color in the schools where I taught. Sometimes I was the only one. And so that can be isolating, and that can be very challenging, particularly when you're a new teacher, right? Like, it's hard enough being a new teacher and then not having colleagues and peers who you feel reflect sort of who you are, who you can identify with. And this is more than just race, right? This is about culture. It's about, you know, who people feel some affinity to for a variety of reasons. And race is one part of it. And so, you know, if we are going to increase racial diversity in some of these areas of our country that themselves are just not diverse, because look, let's not forget that white students benefit from being taught by teachers of color as well. This is about a diverse democracy. Absolutely. I mean, other industries are investing in increasing the racial diversity of their workforce. Teaching is no different than any of the other sectors. And so it's so very important that even in, you know, Nebraska is one of the states in our initiative, even in some parts of Nebraska where it may be 100% white, that we get some Native American teachers in those schools working with those kids, that we get some Black teachers, that we get some Latino teachers working with those kids. And so this is a challenge that we see, you know, back to the grow your own strategies seem to be very promising in relation to that particular challenge. You know, why not cultivate tomorrow's teachers from today?
Let me stop you. If you're in, let's just use your example, rural Nebraska, Kearney, Nebraska, whatever. Okay. I've never been to Kearney, but I assume it's fairly rural. All right. And it looks like Kearney, but it's Kearney. All right. So let's say you're out there in rural Nebraska. You can grow your own teachers. But obviously, from what you just said, if you've got a community that's, I don't know Kearney, I'm just using them as an example, you know, that's mostly Caucasian, so to speak, the grow your own is going to be non-diverse.
That's right. It is going to be non-diverse. And so that leads to another important promising strategy. Thank you for that prompt.
No, you're welcome.
That's right. We are also seeing a lot of states thinking through how they can partner with ed prep programs in other states, particularly what we call minority serving institutions or MSIs. Right. These are your historically Black colleges and universities, your Hispanic serving institutions. And why? Because these are the programs that are actually contributing the largest number and percentage of teachers of color to our nation's workforce. And so in a Nebraska where there are, I believe, some MSIs, probably some tribal serving institutions there. But, you know, to partner with, say, HBCUs in the South, like in Mississippi, like in Arkansas, maybe even on the East Coast in Georgia, to create pipelines so that we can attract candidates of color coming from, you know, these HBCUs and MSIs to these other places in our country where they maybe never even thought, like there's an opportunity there, right?
Right.
There's an opportunity for me to do really good work with kids who, you know, really deserve to see me as someone who knows something, right? Someone who's knowledgeable, someone they can learn from and with. And so that is another promising strategy.
It really is. But I want to ask just the other side of that coin, if I may, Saroja. You just said you're from Trinidad, okay? So you're not African American. You're Trinidadian American, okay?
That's right.
If I may, right. So, you know, Caribbean American, that's better. I know where Trinidad is. You're Caribbean American. All right.
That's
so you're Caribbean American, and it was hard for you, even in a sophisticated area like Montgomery County. By the way, I love what you're doing. I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate here. Okay. So even in Montgomery County, Maryland, a very diverse area. All right. It was hard for you to fit in when everybody else was white, if I could say it that way. Now you're asking people to go to a small town, we're picking on Nebraska, but we'll just keep using them, okay? You know, to go to Nebraska, a small town in Nebraska where, you know, it would be hard to fit in. It's very hard to accomplish what we want to accomplish, I guess. How do you balance those two things? It'd be hard to get kids, students, few teachers, young teachers out there where you have to really fit in. I mean, I live in a small town in Maine. Okay, and I'm a pretty friendly guy and all that, but even with that, we moved here 7-8 years ago. You know, it's hard to break into a small town, so to speak. All right?
Yeah,
much more difficult than a big city, because a big city, you kind of get lost. There's everything. All right? So, and I love where I live. It's Cornish, Maine. Don't worry. I don't mean anything derogatory about that. Everything's fine. But my point is these places, if I may, to a certain extent, are set in their ways, okay, including where I live. And it's hard to break in sometimes. And how do you accomplish that? How do you get those teachers to move to a place that's so different from them, from what they're used
to? That's right. No, that's a great question again, Larry. I'll tell you that this is why there's a two-pronged approach, right, with this work that we're doing. So I'm gonna come back to this question about how do we get more racial diversity in places in our country where it doesn't currently exist. Because actually, maybe we won't even address that, because I'll tell you, that's larger than an education issue, right? That's about sort of just a history in this country that's rooted in, you know, segregation. And so have places in our country where, okay, despite all best efforts, we may never be able to really racially integrate, right? And some of that is people's personal choice. You know, maybe they just don't want to live in that community. But I'll tell you that regardless of whether some rural places in our country integrate sort of racially or not, and whether we can get teachers of color there, what is also very important in this work is that all teachers can demonstrate culturally responsive practice. And culturally responsive practice, yes, it sounds so sort of nebulous, I think, for a lot of folks, because there's just a lot to it, right? But I think at the core of it, what we attempt to really define in the guidance paper, thinking through whether we're talking about initial licensure or their ongoing professional learning, how do we support teachers' development and growth to be the kind of teachers that not only can be, you know, to the term, responsive to the cultures of students in their classroom and creating sort of curriculum and learning experiences that embrace their culture as a learning asset, right, in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But how do we also help these teachers to model for their students, particularly white teachers in these communities we're talking about with white students, model for them tolerance and that diversity is beautiful and that so much can be learned from that? How do we help them to be able to work with their students to combat stereotypes and prejudice and implicit bias, right? So that is why, you know, again, the long title of the initiative, it's so critical, because these are the two goals that states are working on to increase racial diversity, but at the same time ensure all teachers are culturally responsive, or as we sort of pull it all together, they are learner ready. They are ready to teach this diverse group of kids.
They are learning already. And all these things you're saying, and I do agree with all of them, quite obviously. Okay, you know, we do need a more diverse teacher workforce. We want the teachers to be culturally ready to, so that any children that they meet, they're able to teach and understand where they're coming from. But I think, Saroja, and I think you're going to agree with me here, besides the moral aspect of this, there's also educational aspect to this. And I want to ask you this question. If you get more educator diversity, or if you get teachers working more to be more culturally responsive, if I may, to the general nature of the country, or be kids in their class, okay, that has an impact on student achievement, I think. Okay?
It does.
But the better we do at this, the better the kids are going to be. And that's something that may get lost in the shuffle, okay, you know,
yes.
If I may, political correctness, so to speak. We're not just doing it for the sake of political correctness. And you'll know this. And by the way, I wanted to mention this at the beginning. We got right into this. Just so everybody knows this, not only is Saroja a PhD, she's also, and I love this, a National Board Certified Teacher, which is really set something, okay, from NBPTS. I think that's just wonderful. Okay, so I just wanted to make that point. You know what you're talking about there. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
There you go. But talk about student achievement and how that's impacted by what we're talking about here, because that's really the bottom line of this whole thing, besides the moral
aspect.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, truth be told, for me, and I think for a lot of the professionals I work with, that's the number one most important thing. I mean, we got into this industry, into this sector, because we want students to be, you know, receive the best that we have to give them in terms of learning opportunities, right?
Right.
And so it's all about their learning. It's about their achievement and setting them up for success later on, now and later on. And so what we have highlighted also in the beginning of this paper is that research base. We have a very compelling and strong research base for the importance of this work, right? And that shows that students benefit from having a team. And when I say benefit, I don't just mean in terms of the social and emotional part, the building the, you know, tolerance and combating bias. I'm talking about academically, that students academically do benefit from a diverse teacher workforce. But in particular, students of color are showing great academic gains when they've had an opportunity to be taught by a same race teacher before they graduate from high school, particularly young black males in our schools. Men of color, young boys of color, yes, there is compelling evidence that is all, you know, cited in the paper. We've got an extensive set of resources at the end with a research base that, you know, you look at that and you really just can't question why this work is important. We've also been able to, like Larry, I told you, we partnered with so many national collaborating organizations, and we're talking about groups like the Education Trust, the Learning Policy Institute, the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, the two big unions, AFT and NEA, Data Quality Campaign. And so with our partners, we've been able to generate, like really explore, like what is this research base? We're working with some top national researchers on this initiative too. Folks may be familiar with Travis Bristol. He is, if you just Google his name, you'll see that this gentleman is all over this space and has done so much work and research on this. And so we've brought to the initiative, you know, the research experts to inform the practice and policies that hopefully are going to emerge, right, through this work in states and school districts. And so, you know, why this is important? It just is. If we care about education equity for every child, then we have to do this work. We just have to.
We do have to. Indeed, we do. You bring up an interesting point, though, a few minutes ago, and I've always meant to ask this question, and I don't quite understand the result of this. When And this is a weird question. When young black men, and I've done shows on this, have African-American teachers, they do better because they relate better to them. But by the same token, it's to my way of thinking, it's also good for a group of white kids to have an African-American teacher. But
yes.
Because it gives them a sense of diversity and respect for that person, et cetera. All right, not that they have to carry the ball like Jackie Robinson, but you know what I mean. I mean, they
that's right.
They're just working with somebody. But if we say that about young black men, we say the exact opposite about young white guys, okay? Like young mm-hmm. white guys should be taught by black men, and so should young black guys. Do you understand?
Yep.
I hope I'm getting the point across without sounding like an idiot.
Yeah. No, I think you absolutely are. You know, at the end of the day, Larry.
You think I'm an idiot? That's
no,
the way that wouldn't come
I
out.
Do
no,
not
I'm only
think
kidding
you're
you.
Idiot.
I knew that.
Let me tell you something. I appreciate the questions you're asking and sort of the wonderments that you're putting forward, because
yeah.
I think this is exactly what, you know, the states in this initiative, we've been working really hard to identify, like, what are the wonderments people are going to have? Because we need to make sure we know how to respond, right? Let me tell you an early lesson we learned in this work, an early mistake. I won't say it's a mistake. It's a lesson learned. When we first started this work and we first started to think about, you know, increasing racial diversity and being more reflective of the student population, one of the things I think inherently we jumped to was looking at data. Right. And so we started looking mm-hmm. in states at data on what the demographic makeup of the teacher workforce was and of the students. And so I think the initial impulse was, oh, if 70% of our students are students of color in our state, then we need to have our goal is we need 70% of teachers to be teachers of color. Right. What we
mm-hmm.
what we soon realized, sort of the shortcoming of that that approach, is that, that certainly doesn't ensure, you know, meeting that goal doesn't ensure that white kids are going to have an opportunity to be taught by teachers of color before they graduate from high school.
Right.
And it
right.
certainly doesn't help us ensure that students of color will have an opportunity to have a same race teacher, right? Now, those questions open up a whole nother layer of analysis. It's like,
yeah, they do.
Now we need to know where are the teachers?
Exactly.
And who's teaching who, right? So one of the things I put forward to our group was, hey, then here's the data maybe we need to also look at. We need to know by third grade what percentage of our white students in our schools have had an opportunity to be taught by a teacher of color. Boom. That tells us something very different, right, Larry? And what
right.
percentage by third
right.
grade of our students of color have had a same race teacher? And then let's look at those numbers again at eighth grade and at graduation, right? And let's see who's teaching who and if we are actually really getting at that. And then on top of all that, you know, because it's not hard enough just to do that, we also need to really figure out how are we going to know if our teachers are demonstrating culturally responsive practice. Like, what
right.
are the indicators of that? How does that show up on our licensure expectations for new teachers? How does that show up in ongoing teacher evaluations? How do we make sure that the professional learning we give teachers is going to help them grow their practice to be culturally responsive? How do we know that? So these are like the questions, and your wonderments are so very important to that ongoing conversation. So I appreciate you pushing and bringing those forward.
Right. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm on 100% agreement with what you're saying. Okay. In terms of, we need this, we need diversity
yeah.
in our teacher force. Okay. And we need teachers to understand what they have to do when they hit the classroom with a diverse classroom. And it's both ways. Okay.
Yes.
But,
yep.
You know, we want the – actually, I could say it this way. Maybe I'm wrong here. Try this one, Saroja. Do we want mm-hmm. the teacher workforce to – and I think you just answered this a minute ago – to reflect the students, or do we want it to reflect the real world that these kids are going to go into? Okay?
Yeah.
Because – and that's a tough question. That's a
it
really
is.
Tough question. You know, because
I don't know
that
I have that answer. You're right.
I don't know either.
That is, that's a great question. And I think it is a question that I will add, right? Like, as I continue to work with our members, here's another question for you to just think about. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they are, states are really, I got to tell you, I'm so proud. You mentioned how every time you talk to these chiefs, you know, how just what an amazing group of people they are.
They really
and
are.
I
they
too,
really are.
I'm really, yeah, I am so, just feel honored that I've been afforded this opportunity to work with our members this way, because we're talking about people who are really passionate and really thoughtful about this. And so their theories of action, you know, what are we doing and why are we doing it? And then how are we going to get there? I think this is another question for them to sort of think through, right? Because that's so real what you just said. There is this tremendous diversity in this country, but what about the world that we're preparing them to go into? And how do we think through that and what that looks like?
I mean, it's really just so much to think about. And I'll tell you, the CCSSO, the organization, as well as its members, the chief state school officers, are the right people to try to go into this and accomplish this. It's a very difficult situation, okay? And we want these kids to succeed, but we not only want them to succeed in school, we want them to exceed in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to succeed in their life, okay? And, you know, it's a really question. Let me ask you this, and I've worked with AACTA. We'll wind down in a few minutes, but I'm just curious. Okay, are the schools of education, and this is something that's very important, teaching future teachers to be more culturally ready, i.e., what you call it, learner ready? Are they, and are they recruiting the right students in terms of diversity? We don't want someone just because they're black. We don't want someone just because they're Asian. We want them to be a good teacher. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, are they recruiting the right students, A, and are they making sure that the students they do have now are going to be ready to teach, and they should be, okay, in a culturally responsive classroom? And the classic example of that, let me just swing from Nebraska to Texas. You know, Texas is becoming very brown, okay? A lot of Latino people, et cetera, okay? The demographics of good old Texas are changing. Everybody knows that. The teachers at all the Texas colleges have to be taught to deal with these children, which is a different culture than what they're used to. That's speech.
Right. Yeah.
No, answer. Yeah. What are the colleges of education doing? You work with AACTE.
Well, I do. And AACTE is a partner, you know, on this project as well.
Yeah, they're
great
people.
I don't know if you've heard of the Branch Alliance of Educator Diversity. So this is another fairly new organization that is working directly with the HBCUs and other MSIs to build their capacity around preparing teachers. And so I think that between these two organizations as partners on this, you know, we've got the right folks at the table with states, with local school districts, to really kind of come together and think about, you know, well, again, like, what is that criteria? And maybe we need to challenge the criteria we're using in our current recruitment policies, because it's not serving us well. You know, Larry, too, you can't forget that beyond just this, you know, oh, we've got to go find the superstars that we're looking for and then prepare them. We really, and everyone is taking this on, we've got to think about what preparation looks like. You know, there's alt prep, there are these quick routes in, there are these longer routes in, and even longer if you look in the state of California, you have to have a master's degree to teach, right? So there's a number of pathways in. We don't have good, you know, any conclusive evidence about which is the right. There is no silver bullet here. And so we have to be flexible. We're going to have to be able to be nimble as we keep our eyes on the prize, which is getting the right teacher well-prepared in front of our kids. Look, until everyone sees kids in schools today, every one of them as their own, we are going to be hard-pressed to solve this problem.
That's a great line, and it's true. Okay, they have
it
to see
real.
The kids as
it's
their
real.
Own. It is.
And
it is
Larry,
real.
This is coming from a lady that don't have no kids of her own.
I think
kids,
you're pretty good to be working with
kids.
And I just got to say something, which as we were talking, it struck me. I went to school in West Philadelphia, okay, which in an all-white neighborhood called Overbrook Park when I was a kid. And that's where I grew up. And all my teachers were white and everybody in school was white. That was Lamberton when it was an elementary school. I think it's a high school now, okay? And then I remember I went to Bieber Junior High School, okay, which is a five times the size, okay? And there were all these black people there and black teachers. I almost dropped dead. I didn't even know such a thing existed, okay?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I'm a kid. I'm in seventh grade. I'm a little kid, okay, 12 years old. And all of a sudden, I was surrounded, okay? And not surrounded, okay, but there were a lot of black educators, black kids in my classrooms, et cetera, et cetera. I remember it took me a long while to adjust to that. Okay, so swing it around to the other side. I mean, we're talking a long time ago, too. But swing it around to the other side. We got to make sure that kids who have been immersed with everybody who's African-American or whatever in their neighborhood, people of color, all of a sudden go into the real work world, go outside of the neighborhood, and boom, they're surrounded by white people and every other diverse group you can think of. All right,
that's
and they
right.
got to be able to work with that because that shock. I still remember that was. I haven't thought about it in years, but this conversation brought up the memory. I still remember the shock, and I'm a little kid. But you know that it's difficult. You got a real challenge on your hand, and I know you're doing a good job. They got the right person for this one, Saroja. You,
I appreciate you, Larry. Thank you so much. Well, you
right.
know it's a team of it's a team, and everybody is in this together, and we're just not going to stop. You know. The goal right
oh,
now
no,
is by 2025,
not.
We're going to see a difference by 2025.
Absolutely. And I'll say it again,
yep.
you know, as I talk to the chief state school officers, you know, they're far removed, so to speak, from the classroom teacher, all right? But they really, they're as a group, the 50 of them and their teams are really excellent, and they're really trying to get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on in the classroom and make it work in every state. They're really trying.
Mm-hmm.
You're the classic example of that. They're not so far
That's
removed.
Right.
They're not so far removed.
That's
thank
right.
you, Saroja. This was great. I enjoyed
Larry,
every
thank
minute
thank you
of
so
this.
Much.
You're
me
wonderful.
Me too. Me too.
Okay.
Thank you.
You take care. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so
all
much.
All right. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye. Great lady. That's Dr. Saroja, S-A-R-O-J-A, Saroja Warner, PhD, and even better, National Board Certified Teacher, okay, over at CCSSO, Council of Chief State School Officers. And what I said a minute ago is true. Maybe they may seem removed. They're not as removed as you might think if you're working in the trenches. They're trying to make the trenches really work better, and I found that state by state by state. Okay, we'll archive the show, education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out over at EduTalk Radio. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks for listening, and a big shout-out to Nancy Rodriguez over at CCSSO for helping me put together the show. Thanks, Nancy.